Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You are listening to NPR News, and I'm Angela Davis. Glad you could join us today. Is it possible to be prejudiced without realizing it? The answer is yes. Bias is in the cultural air we breathe, and often these unexamined attitudes directly conflict with our values, values like fairness and equality. Today, we're talking about the harm bias causes and how to recognize it and how to address it in our individual lives and in our workplaces, in our schools. If prejudice is a habit, can it be unlearned? The phone lines are open this hour. Have you had a moment when you suddenly became aware of your own bias? What brought it to your attention? Did your behavior change? And have you been treated in a way that revealed someone else's bias? How did it affect you? You can call us at 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. Tweet me at Angela Davis, NPR. To help us walk through how bias works, we're joined by Jessica Nordell. Jessica is a science and cultural journalist in Minneapolis who is out with her first book. It's called The End of Bias, A Beginning. And a bit later, we'll talk to two Augsburg education professors who are teaching colleagues in higher education how to spot the ways that bias is baked into professional norms at predominantly white institutions. But first, good morning to you, Jessica.
Good morning.
So let's start with some language and some terms. I'm already getting questions from folks who are asking for a definition of bias. And are bias and prejudice, are those terms interchangeable? Exactly what is bias?
Yeah, so when we think about unconscious or unintentional bias, what we're talking about is this kind of specific phenomenon that happens where we grow up in a particular culture, and as a result, we learn the categories of people that are kind of salient or relevant in that culture. And along the way, we also learn associations and stereotypes that are connected to those categories. And what happens in the case of what we think of as unconscious bias or unintentional bias is that when we encounter a person who we recognize as belonging to one of those categories, all of those associations and stereotypes that have been stored up in our memory can start to influence the way that we react to a person. And they can influence the way we feel, the way we talk, how we behave, how we evaluate the person. And the thing that's kind of unique about this kind of bias is that it can happen really automatically and really quickly, like so quickly that we don't even necessarily realize that we're being influenced. And additionally, it can really conflict with who we believe ourselves to be. So we might think of ourselves as really egalitarian and fair-minded, but then behave in a way that totally contradicts that.
Yes. Yes. And so, again, to getting at that question about the word prejudice and the word bias, do you see those as interchangeable terms or no?
I mean, I think it depends on what kind of bias we're talking about. When we think of prejudice, what comes to mind is really kind of overt dislike or disregard for a particular group of people that is sort of deeply held. And so that behavior is in line with values. Like if someone really believes that, for instance, men are more competent than women and they really, you know, stand by that and then they behave that way, that would be, you know, a prejudice against women. But when we think about unconscious bias, often someone like that might think, oh, no, I think women and men should be treated equally. But then when that behavior conflicts with it, that's what we're talking about when we talk about unconscious bias.
So, Jessica, what got you interested in this topic? I know that you've had a personal experience with how bias might work.
Yeah, you know, my eyes were sort of opened to the starkness of bias when I was a young journalist, actually here in Minneapolis. I was in my 20s and I was writing for some local and regional publications. And when I started pitching stories to national outlets, I wasn't hearing a response back. So I was just getting kind of silence from editors. And I had one particular moment where I was pitching an essay, and it had like a very sort of specific, it was tied to a specific moment in time. So I was kind of running out of time for anyone to be interested in it. And I had this kind of moment of desperation where I thought, well, I'll try something new. And so I sent out the same pitch, the same essay, but I changed the name. And so instead of it coming from Jessica, it came from JD Nordell. And I had a new email address and a new, mm-hmm. Signature. And the piece was accepted within hours. And it was the same piece. It was, wow. the same pitch. So that was pretty eye-opening to me.
So that's an example of gender bias.
Yes.
Wow. Jessica, we're already getting phone calls from folks, and I want to bring them in early as we talk about bias and how to identify it, what it is, and whether or not we can, address it. In Minneapolis, Mark is on the phone. And Mark, what do you want to share with us as we discuss bias?
Hey, thank you so much for taking me. I think this is really fascinating, and I want to just give you a little background to explain. I mean, I've lived like over 30 years in North Minneapolis. I grew up in rural Iowa, raised my kids, right a few blocks from North High. And so they've grown up in the community. And so we've lived in a community as a white family and a predominantly black community. I've dedicated most of my life to addressing bias issues, trying to teach other European Americans about it. So several years ago, when my son was in high school, I was driving home. I was driving down Emerson Avenue right near Broadway. Many of you might know the area. And it was dusk. And pulling up toward the light, I'm still about a block away. And I can see there's this young man, and it's can just see silhouettes coming off the curb and obviously like walking towards my car. And I can see he's in a hoodie. He's got baggy jeans on. And immediately I felt a little nervous. And I knew I shouldn't like panic, but I felt some nervousness. And then I pull up and I realize it's my son who wants to ride the rest of the way home. And I think to me, I remember that story because it just shows as much as we try to identify and deal with our biases, there's things that we grew up with. We identify our culture. I don't know. And I would love to hear the guest's thoughts about that. And also for the guest from Augsburg, that son went on to graduate from the education department at Augsburg, is now a vice principal in Colorado.
All right. Well, Mark, I want to go back to something you said. Three things I heard there. Young man, hoodie, and baggy jeans. And then it caused you to have a feeling.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that feeling was fear.
Yeah. And it was like, why is he walking through it? And this nervousness, and it was just a split matter of seconds until I realized it was my own kid. But it just caused this nervousness for a second. And yeah.
It stuck with you. Jessica, what do you hear there in Mark's story?
It's so interesting. And I think, that point about feeling is really important. There's a lot of research that suggests that the way we feel is actually a stronger predictor of how we behave than what we think. And mm-hmm. feelings come up so quickly and so mm-hmm. automatically, like the guest suggested, that it's incredibly powerful and can be extremely dangerous, if we react to those feelings without taking some time to really investigate where they're coming from.
So how does someone know that they're being perceived or treated differently than someone else? I mean, you can't really know, can you?
This is one of the biggest challenges. And, because we each only live in we're inside of one
body. Right.
Body. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And, one of the things that can be so challenging about this kind of more subtle bias, or not necessarily subtle, but unintentional or really sort of automatic bias, is that we don't always know. And there's research that finds that like facing this kind of bias, this sort of unintentional, unconscious bias in, for instance, a workplace, can actually be more challenging for people to deal with than overt discrimination, because it's really hard to figure out what's going on. And people then start to ask themselves, wait, am I making things up? Am I imagining it? Right. Maybe I'm overreacting. So it's extremely challenging.
So what are some of the studies of bias that have really stayed with you as you wrote the book? We know that bias shows up in schools and workplaces, in policing and healthcare. But what are some of the studies that stand out to you?
Oh my gosh, there are so many that are so stark. So for instance, you mentioned healthcare. One of the studies that has stayed with me that is really haunting is there are actually many studies that show disparities in the way Black patients and white patients are treated. And the one that stands out is about vascular disease. So there are studies that show that Black patients with vascular disease are more likely to undergo an amputation for a limb as opposed to a limb sparing treatment when you compare them to white patients. And that's even taking into account things like the severity of the disease, insurance status, the quality of the hospital. And it really, I think, shines a spotlight on essential questions about what, you know, why people are being treated differently, and really what this says about who matters, who has value in our society.
I want to take another phone call, Jessica, as we talk about bias and studies that look into bias. Jessica's the author of a new book called The End of Bias, A Beginning. And we want to know your stories. Is there a moment when you suddenly became aware of your own bias or someone else's? And how did it affect you? You can call us at 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. It's another number you can use. And Wilmer, Steve is on the phone. And Wilmer, what do you want to tell us about bias?
Oh, yeah. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. So a while back, my wife is a principal at an elementary school, and we were at a store shopping for some furniture when her assistant principal also was at the same store, and he's male, my wife's female, and the female customer service rep came up, was hearing our conversation, and deferred to him as the principal. And my wife had, or he actually told her, no, she's the principal. And so I just wanted to kind of mention about how these gender, unconscious gender biases happen. Mm-hmm. But then I'm also thinking, as I was thinking about before I came, just came on the call, is that my wife deals with that every day in the administrative cycle, as she is one of three females in a group of seven. And every time they come up with a suggestion or say something, it tends not to be heard by the superintendent who's male, by the other male people. And then if something else is mentioned by the male counterpart, then everybody kind of responds to it. So my wife, who's 5'3", has been dealing with this in her entire life, and is one of those unfortunate things that it's still extremely common. It's one of those real gender biases that we have.
Thank you for sharing that. That's Steve and Wilmer. Let's take another phone call as we talk about bias and how it shows up and the harm it causes. In Stillwater, Charlie's on the phone. Good morning, Charlie.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I just want to just a few comments here. One is, I refer to it as being prejudgmental, whether it's race or gender or as a form of color just spoke to, height or weight or garbage collector or you're a car salesman. We have these prejudgments that we naturally make. I think it's part of human nature, part of our DNA, unfortunately. For me, I had a trigger experience back when I was a freshman in college. I come from a family with a lot of roots back in the deep south, and a lot of discrimination against African Americans. Well, I had a housemate, a freshman in college, who was African-American guy, a ROTC student, who was like way smarter, way more impressive, way more articulate than me. So I called him smelly. These people can be very high achieving. And more recently, teaching at Metro State University, a lot of smelly immigrants, these people are smart, motivated. I mean, I've been blessed to have lots of great relationships with people that are different than me. And so there are those kind of those trigger moments that really are telling and they're awakening. But I think for me, the takeaway is education, being more broad-minded, being more thoughtful.
Mm. And so you recognize, based on what you experienced as a child and how you viewed people as a child, it's very different than how you view them now?
Oh, yes. Yes, for sure. And I think the book To Kill a Mockingbird, I read that in school, and that was probably a moment where I had some change in thinking. But more recently, obviously, with other experiences firsthand, it became much more telling.
Thank you. That's Charlie in Stillwater calling in as we talk about bias. I want to bring in two other guests into the conversation now as we talk about bias, how to recognize it, and whether it can be unlearned. We're joined now by Terrence Kwame Ross, an associate professor of education at Augsburg University in Minneapolis and former chair of the education department. Good morning to you, Terrence.
Good morning, Angela.
Hi, and we also have Peg Finders on the line. Peg is a retired professor of education at Augsburg and a former department chair as well. Hi, Peg.
Good morning.
So, Peg and Terrence, you're working together now to help colleagues at Augsburg notice bias in the workplace, and you've created a workshop around the common ways that many white people unconsciously act to silence or dismiss colleagues who are people of color. And you call these white talk moves. And I understand you started thinking about this during faculty meetings. I want to hear all about this. Terrence, describe for me what you noticed happening at these staff meetings after you joined the education department there at Augsburg.
I think it's universal, first of all. And it gets to some of the conversations you've been talking about, and particularly with Jessica, around is this really happening? Like, all these years, is this still happening? And so I just turned a rigorous eye to it. And we know that color and sound and shape and form and number translate to social categories like age and gender and skin color. And so as educators, we know that these things are automatic, are unconscious, are intentional, but they can be unlearned. And so what I started to do with PEG is just to empirically, what we call observe, track, record people's body language, their thoughts and actions, and how that manifested, as I believe, as racial reflexes towards me. And so it was fun, but it was also a way to look at things in real time. Bias happens, Angela, in real time.
And Terrence, I should add that you're a black man in a predominantly like white female field of education, and you've said that you just couldn't be yourself. What do you mean by that?
Well, like we're talking right now, right? That I felt that people with PhDs, people with education, should know these basic things, and particularly when it comes to teaching children, that throughout our society, historical forces, social forces, our culture, they're all based on particular ways for us to see and feel in the world. And they are biased. And so we have to recognize those. So in terms of the African-American vernacular English, if I go into, oh, Angela, you know what I'm talking about, girl, I couldn't do that. That's a no-no. I had to be a particular kind of black person. So it gets to some stereotypes around slavery in terms of, you know, being seen and not heard. So it's a lot of levels, Angela, but that's what I mean. But you can be yourself in terms of language, in terms of what I bring, in terms of analyzing situations, that I can see things that they may not see based on being a black male in America historically.
Peg, I'm wondering, what did you notice happening during these faculty meetings, and what did you notice in yourself?
Well, what I noticed is I consider myself an ally, and I've been doing this work for a long time. But when Terrence came into the department, I kept thinking, he makes me really uncomfortable. He makes me really uncomfortable. And then I turned the lens on myself and realized it was my language bias. The ways that we use language in higher ed and department meeting, it was commonsensical. And I always found myself trying to school him, and this is how you talk, this is what you do, instead of realizing it was a bias about appropriateness of talk in higher ed. So as Terrence said, together, we started looking at what is it that is the appropriateness of how you talk in department meetings, and realized that so much of it was really silencing people of color, and we were either silencing them or schooling them. This is the way you use language. So we started this really productive collaboration.
I'm trying to envision this because what is the appropriate way to talk in a meeting? Is it slow and methodical? I mean, are you not supposed to have emotion? I don't understand.
So there's a set of volume level, a tone, a turn taking that is just common sense of how you talk in meetings. So early on, when Terrence would say something, now I would say he was talking loud. Terrence would say, Peg, I'm not talking loud. It's your interpretation of loud. So what we found was by starting to do sort of an ethnography of language, what was considered commonsensical ways with words and what were the ways that people would try to monitor that and keep it under control, which allowed white people to hold the floor the whole time.
Now, Terrence, I know you write about and talk about something called tone policing. Tell me what tone policing is and the reactions that you've seen white people make in meetings.
Yeah, tone policing can be defined as when white person shut down the talk of a person of color because it is perceived by the white person as being delivered in an angry or charged way. So tone policing condemns the tone of the talk and prevents the ideal of the speaker to be communicated. So as you see right now, Angela, the way I'm talking, and if I'm trying to make my point, I might say, wait, hold up one second. I need to process this. And so by slowing down the conversation and start to notice what is happening to me, just that very idea of a black male having power to name and identify what's happening in the meeting that may be experienced and felt as race, white folks then tone police because they try to pivot, right, everything away from something that is original sin, and that is the concept and the creation of race that has caused us hail and pain in America.
And so
tone policing is an intentional kind of move. People of color won't articulate sort of what they're feeling and what they're thinking and their ideas in a meeting.
So this sounds really uncomfortable, what's going on, but somehow you and Peg got together and like, look, why don't we just study what's happening? How did that come about, Peg?
Well, I just talked to Terrence in my office and I said, what I'd like you to do is focus on what we're doing here and let's see if we can figure out a way to work through this. And we're both scholars, we're both ethnographers, so we thought this will be a very interesting study if we just start taking notes and keeping track. And so we did that. And, you know, another move we found often made is white sidestepping. And I found myself guilty of that. We've named white sidestepping as whenever the topic of race comes up, a white person will say, let's move away from race. Let's talk about something else. And that was quite common in our department. But we want to emphasize it's not just our department. It's pretty universal that it happens is that white people don't want to talk about race. So that's one of the moves they make. So Terrence and I would go to a meeting and after the meeting, we'd come together and we had created these grids of keeping track and then did it elsewhere and really found this productive way of naming these moves. And back to what Jessica was saying is by naming them, we make them visible so that they're no longer pre-reflective. They have to be reflective because now we have a name for these kinds of moves that people use in talk.
I want to remind our listeners we're talking about bias, and I want to know, have you had an experience like you've heard Terrence and Peg and Jessica describe? Have you had an experience that made you aware of your own bias? What was it? Did it change the way you thought or behaved? You can call us at 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. Before we take a news break, I want to take one more call and Sartell. Joni's on the line, and Joni, I want to hear what you have to say about this.
Well, I'm 71 years old, and I'm a female, and always have been. And when I turned 18, I became an adult. But at age 71, I am still being referred to day in and day out, no matter where I go, as a girl. And I want to know, when am I going to be able to grow up and be called a woman or a lady? We don't often anymore refer to men as boys, although there's kind of a color thing in there. And sad but true, sometimes men who are of color and not white are referred to as boys. That's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about all women, no matter our ethnic origin or circumstances or color.
Another example of gender bias, Joni's describing in Sartell. Jessica, we've talked about gender bias. What are you hearing what she just shared?
Yeah, it's true. And I think that I think one thing that is so liberating about what the Oxford professors mentioned is that once you start to see what's happening, then and you start to name it, then you can actually start to change. So you can't change necessarily how people respond to you, but you can start changing the way that you respond to other people. And you can, that awareness of what's happening is really the beginning of agency. It's the beginning of the ability to change.
I can't believe people are calling Joni and Sartell, girl, she's 71 years old. That has to, the feeling that creates, as we talk about the harm that bias causes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Well, we are talking about bias, how to recognize it in ourselves, whether we can unlearn it. But right now we're going to take a break to check on what's happening in the news. Phil Picardi, tell us what's going on. Yes, that is 1A next at 10 a.m. here on NPR News. And coming up at noon, it's Minnesota Now, hosted by Kathy Werzer. Tomorrow morning at 9, I'm talking about college admissions and the enrollment drop that educators are seeing at community colleges nationwide and here in Minnesota. What does this trend mean for higher education? That's tomorrow morning at 9. And on the podcast for the show, you can listen to the conversations I had earlier this week about bad bosses and their impact on the economy and our mental health, and the discussion I had with guests and listeners about what it's like to lose the language that your parents and grandparents spoke, the guilt and shame that comes with the loss of a language. All right, download the podcast for NPR News with Angela Davis, and you can listen whenever it's convenient for you.
Programming is supported by Securian Financial, offering insurance, investment, and retirement solutions that give you the confidence to enjoy the here and now, so you can make every moment count. Learn more at Securian.com.
Now back to the conversation about bias, how to recognize it, and whether or not we can unlearn bias. My guests include Jessica Nordell. Jessica is a science and cultural journalist in Minneapolis who's out with her first book, The End of Bias, A Beginning. And we're also joined by Terrence Kwame Ross, an associate professor of education at Augsburg University in Minneapolis and former chair of the education department, as well as Peg Fenders, a retired professor of education at Augsburg and a former department chair. And we're taking your calls. The number is 651-227-6000, or you can call us at 800-242-2828 to share your stories. Let's go back to the phone lines. In St. Paul, we have Izzy on the phone, and thank you for waiting. Izzy, what did you want to share with us?
Hi. So I live in, before, when I was younger, I came to from Africa, and I used to watch a lot of TVs in Africa. And my first time coming to America, I came across an African-American male, and I was really scared. I went running to my parents crying. And I realized that sometimes, even when we're not in the environment, the pre-instilled biases from, the cinematic portrayal of a group of people really shocks you. I mean, I lived in Africa with a bunch of Black people. But having that experience was
so, Izzy, I'm having a hard time hearing you, but you're talking about bias based on watching movies or taking in media, that created bias in you as a child. Are you still there, Izzy?
Yes, right. That's what I'm talking about.
All right, Jessica, can you speak to that and the role that the media or that movies can play in this?
Absolutely. I mean, these kinds of stereotypes that Izzy is talking about are really surrounding us in sort of 24/7 and 360 surround sound. We absorb them at a really young age, not only from the media, but from parents, from neighbors and communities, even just from observing the way our sort of built environment is created, the way communities are segregated, all of these things contribute to these really deeply embedded stereotypes that are so, as you know, as she pointed out, like so deep and so spontaneous that they can affect the way we feel, even if we don't necessarily believe those things to be true. They can sort of creep up on us unawares and have really harmful consequences in many cases.
Let's take another call in Minneapolis. Ron is on the phone. Good morning, Ron. What can you tell us about bias?
Hey, and I immensely appreciate you and your team giving space for this conversation. I've never heard this given this kind of stage. So, I mean, I've been on the receiving end of it plenty of times in my career. I have been a journalist for 20 plus years and pretty accomplished based on awards and where my work gets reviewed, gets seen. But when it comes to, when it has come to my professional journey, I have to wonder where I would be today if I hadn't been repeatedly told that my voice is threatening, that people can't tell me, people don't know what's going on in my head. I've definitely been policed in tone, been told that just my normal speaking volume is aggressive and threatening, and that has absolutely barred me from different positions.
And what form of media do you work with, Ron?
I've been a broadcast photojournalist. I had been a broadcast photojournalist for years. Currently, I'm a cinematographer and editor in town.
And so when you hear this conversation, do you feel like bias can, that people even recognize it in themselves, or that there's an opportunity to, that the people could change?
I have to think that there is the opportunity for people to change, whether or not, I mean, whether or not people recognize it as an individual journey. I have to have faith that people can change. But it's hard to, after having experienced it for as long as I have.
Ron, describe the harm it's caused you, either career-wise or personally.
Like I said, career-wise, where I am today is a very comfortable position, and I'm doing some great work. But the paths not taken and not gained that I have gone after, that is always a question mark for me. And emotionally, it's driven me to the point where I have fallen into periods where I've questioned just the use of my voice and moderated myself. I can go back and listen to recordings of myself from 10 years ago that sound dramatically different. The bass might be a little more modulated. I definitely, and anybody who knows me would speak up to the fact that I speak much less often today than I did even years ago.
Well, Ron, I want to ask one of our guests about what you've shared with us. Terrence Kwame Ross there, as you listen to Ron describe his story as a Black man and communicating with people, like, what are you thinking?
Oh, when he was talking, it just brought back sort of these emotions and structures that I can see. What I can say is that it can be unlearned, and the power is when the person names it, at least for themselves, right? Because when this stuff happens, you're asking yourself constantly, is this really happening? You know, so is that, oh, is this true? So it goes back to, then what's the evidence? But you know what you're feeling. You know that you could, that a pattern is a discernible regularity, right? And so, as Jessica knows, and Peg, I can wrap it up by saying what is impacted is his self-concept of himself. So there's a whole research out there around self-concept and how stereotypes and biases impact how people see themselves.
And Peg, what did you hear there? Ron, who says he's a Black cinematographer, what he was describing?
Well, what I hear is that he needed to change himself. And one thing that Terrence and I have been trying to focus on is how do we change white institutional spaces? So rather than say it's on him as a black man that he needs to change, we need to think about what are the structures that while we consider ourselves a university that's very open to diversity, we're always asking people of color to change to fit in as opposed to changing the biases in the institution.
Let us take another phone call as we talk about bias, how to recognize it and how to address it. In St. Paul, we have Greg on the phone. Greg, what do you want to share with us?
Thank you. Bias is very important in the context we're talking about with how we treat people that are different or not different from us. It's one of the huge issues of our day. My point is that bias is a broad, common human characteristic. I work in medicine. I'm a physician. And there was a body of work in marketing by Daniel Kahneman and a colleague that led to the Nobel Prize. The book that summarizes that is called Thinking Fast and Slow. And it really changed the way people in medicine thought about the hundreds, sometimes thousands of decisions we make every day. When you make a lot of decisions quickly, you make a lot of errors. We call it heuristics, but it's bias. When you take time to think about those few decisions that you say, this is important, I'm going to take my time, you're much less likely to err. And I think that happens in human interactions all the time. We see somebody, one of the gentlemen talked about seeing his son with a hoodie. Mm-hmm. He didn't take a long time to think about who is this individual coming to my car? How should I think about him? He saw one article of clothing at night, and he made a quick decision, and it was a bad one. The thing you've been asking Ms. Davis, all along, can we change? And I would say that in medicine, once we learn these errors, we really improve the way we make decisions. Some of it was individual knowledge to watch for the pitfalls. Some of it was systemic changes we put in place to not put us in a situation where we would make these quick decisions without thinking. So it's a huge problem, but I have some optimism that if we think about and especially think about it broadly and borrow from other areas that we can really improve how we treat each other.
Now, Greg, I've hosted some discussions here in the last year and a half dealing particularly with medicine and what's happening in healthcare. And I know there's a push right now among medical school students saying, hey, we need to start talking about bias and race as we learn about medicine. Do you think that that's part of the solution is in the training that our future doctors are having these conversations while they're still in medical school?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. I talked very broadly about all these decisions. We also have a lot of biases that do apply to how we treat people from different ethnicities, different skin colors, men and women. There's no doubt about that. We also have biases about people who are there because of what some might call self-inflicted illnesses like alcoholism or eating too much, as opposed to people who have bad genes. We have huge numbers of biases that are more related to your conversation today. Mm-hmm. Yes, we are. Well, first we try to admit medical students who already are predisposed to think fairly and equitably about other people. Anybody who's ever been admissions knows that that's not always, you know, you're not always successful in recognizing it. But yes, when people get to medical school, we do make huge efforts to try and eliminate those or help people recognize them so that over the lifetime of their practice, they can make sure to treat everybody respectfully, equally, provide
Greg,
the best possible care.
Greg, thank you for calling and sharing what you've seen in your experience working in medicine as a doctor. I appreciate it. Let's take another phone call as we talk about bias in Minneapolis. Kristen is on the phone. And Kristen, what do you want to share with us? What have you seen when it comes to bias?
Hi, I am a white woman, and I'm also a Muslim convert. And so I used to wear hijab, which is the scarf on my hair. And it was really interesting to see the different experiences that I had when wearing it versus not wearing it. To give you an example, with my children, I would bring my children into school, and I could tell that when I was wearing it, they were a lot less responsive to my concerns, a lot less quick to set up appointments than when I'm not wearing it now. A different experience, as an example, was when I was wearing it. I am educated from Georgetown, well-spoken, perfect English, and yet when I wore hijab, people honestly didn't think they were hearing English. They would constantly ask me to repeat myself or say, I'm sorry, I don't understand you. And so it was kind of fascinating to see other people's perceptions change just because I had a piece of material on my head, changing the way that they viewed me.
Thank you for sharing that. That's Kristen in Minneapolis. And Jessica, in your book, do you look at religious bias as well?
I do. I do look a little bit at religious bias. And for instance, the way that crimes are reported by media when the crime is committed by a person of Muslim origin, there is more reporting on the crime. The religion is mentioned more often than if that same kind of crime is committed by someone of Christian origin, for instance. So I think that, the caller has a really interesting story because she through just, taking off or putting on an article of clothing is able to see so starkly the way these differences in behavior manifest in a way that maybe she wouldn't if she, if she had only experienced life with hijab or without the hijab.
Peg, I want to ask you about the workshop that you and Terrence have created to help people identify and understand some of the biases that show up in the workplace. It's called White Talk Moves. You've taken this kind of on the road. You've done it there at Augsburg, but you've gone to some other places too. What has that been like, and how have people responded to what you've tried to demonstrate to them?
Well, what we've demonstrated, we give them cases similar to what the callers have called in. Several cases where you're looking at the ways that particular talk silences people. So it's very hands-on, very voices on a practice. I want to go back to what the caller said. One of the white talk moves we've identified is called overvoicing. And that caller identified that people couldn't understand her when she had the hijab on. Mm-hmm. We found that oftentimes white people take over the talk of someone of color and overvoice them and try to say what they're saying as if they couldn't be understood as individuals. So in the workshops that we have done, and we're going to be doing a medical one coming up soon, what we do is give people practice. And overwhelmingly, the people of color say, well, yes, I experience this every day. This happens. And white people, for the first time, are recognizing their bias and bringing it to a level to be reflective. So they've been quite positive interactions. And one institution we've actually gone to several times for follow-up, because as Jessica says, workshops can't be a one-shot deal, but we want to bring it to a conscious level and then actually give practice in how to disrupt those in the moment.
Mm-hmm. I want to take a quick break from our conversation for a moment. For those of you who have been following closely the case of former Minneapolis police officer Mohammed Noor, I just received word from the newsroom that they've received word that former Minneapolis police officer Mohammed Noor has been sentenced to 57 months in prison in the death of Justine Ruschek. And that is more than the 41 months his attorneys had asked for. As you may know, there was a new sentencing hearing this morning that started at 9. And we have the details coming in now. Again, that former Minneapolis police officer Mohammed Noor has been sentenced to 57 months in prison in the death of Justine Ruschek, and that is more than the 41 months his attorneys had asked for. We will, of course, have more details in the newscast that's coming up right after the show and throughout this afternoon throughout All Things Considered. All right. We're talking about bias right now and taking calls from our listeners as well as talking to our guests. Let's talk to one of our listeners in St. Paul. This is Karen. Karen, what do you want to tell us about bias?
Hi, Angela.
Hi.
Many years ago, I had a job that involved sitting in the cockpit of Northwest Airlines flights and listening on a headset to the transactions that would occur between the pilots and the air traffic controllers on the ground. And one day we were flying into Memphis, Tennessee, a Northwest hub, and I was listening to the radio transmissions that were very slow and okay. with a southern drawl.
All right.
And I had an epiphany at that moment that because my feeling about what I heard was that that person was not particularly bright or intelligent or capable, which I think was principally because I had interacted with people from all different parts of our country and many other countries and had never felt that way necessarily. But I checked myself and had a light bulb moment and realized that that was a horrific bias that I held. I was raised in the Midwest by two English professors and speak more quickly. But just having that self-recognition has helped me for the next 25 years in being aware of my own bias. And
being self-aware, that is really a big part of this. It's just, you know, having a moment that you become aware.
Absolutely.
Right. Jessica, I want to ask you about this. You know, there are a lot of corporate diversity training programs right now focused on bias. Do they work?
That's a great question. You know, this is a huge topic, but, you know, one of the challenges with corporate diversity trainings is that they're often not evaluated. So we don't actually know if they're working. Sometimes they're presented in a way where we don't even really know what the specific goal is for the training. So there are some trainings that have been evaluated and have been shown to actually change people's behavior, which is our goal, right? Like what we're trying to do with these trainings is hopefully make people act in a less discriminatory way and a more inclusive and life-affirming way. And some do have some evidence behind them. Some don't. So there's a lot of unknowns about whether all of the money that we're putting into corporate diversity trainings is actually making a dent in the problem.
Terrence, do you think that we can unlearn bias? And, you know, these are uncomfortable conversations. There's a lot of shame associated with it. You know, what gives you hope that the work that you and Peg are doing is going to make a difference?
Well, as an educator, you know, that's the field I chose to help people learn and unlearn different concepts and also different misconceptions. So the way I approach this is not in particularly a way that you say, you know, is it working? Can you identify the particular behaviors? That's important. But also, Angela, what's also important is the awareness of it, to name it, to help people identify their motives and motivations around when they catch themselves around certain kind of thinking and acting towards someone. So I think bias can be unlearned, but it's a lifelong process. And in the research, we call it metacognitive. People in the moment have to think, have to be able to think about their thinking and what they're feeling at that moment that something comes to their consciousness that gives them cognitive dissonance. Wow, what I just felt doesn't match with what I really believe. And that's hard work. That's hard.
So we shouldn't ignore our gut instinct. We should, you know, think about why we have these feelings and really lean into that, that could be the key to all of this. Our time is up, but I do want to thank our guests who made time for us today. We've been talking with Jessica Nordell, a science and cultural journalist in Minneapolis, who's out with her first book. It's called The End of Bias, A Beginning. Thank you, Jessica. Good luck with your new book. And Terrence Kwame Ross, an associate professor of education at Augsburg University, along with Peg Fenders, a retired professor of education at Augsburg, the two of them working together and providing that workshop, White Talk Moves, to help us learn and identify bias. All right. Thank you for your time. This conversation was produced by Maya Beckstrom. Be safe. We'll talk to you tomorrow morning at 9.
Thanks for listening to a recording of my live radio show on NPR News. A reminder, if you want to catch the show in real time, tune in and call in at a new time, 9 a.m. weekdays on NPR News.